Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. All the items in this edition concern events that are either happening at the moment or are coming up very shortly in the Brighton and Hove area. We start off by hearing from a local man who's a regular participant in the London to Brighton Veteran Car Run, which happens on November the 7th. Then we'll hear about a fundraising campaign taking place in November by the military charity Help for Heroes, and about a campaign that the RSPCA are running throughout October to encourage people who are thinking about getting a pet to adopt a rescued animal from one of their centres rather than going out and buying a new pet. And finally, we'll hear from the new artistic director of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra about the plans that she has in mind for the future. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So, without any further ado, here's Chris English to introduce the first item.
Veteran cars and the Dion Buton car in particular, and Michael Edwards from Brighton. How long have you had your Dion?
Well, I've had the car for slightly more than 25 years, but it has been in my family since 1932, which is quite a lot longer.
The history of the car run we know quite well, and this year is the 125th, I believe.
It is. 125 years ago, there was a number of pieces of legislation that were passed in Parliament, which effectively gave a foundation to the use of motor cars in this country. It was a pivotal moment, and so the London to Brighton run is a celebration of what happened in 1896. I mean, just put briefly, before that time, people made their way around the country by horse-drawn carriages. They would carry freight by canal barge or coastal steamer, and of course there was the train. Most people didn't travel very far. They didn't travel beyond their city, their town, or even sometimes their village. People had begun to appreciate the benefits of travel purely through the bicycle, actually. Bicycle was introduced in this country in the 1880s, early 1890s, and people for the first time could go where they wanted to go and not where the train took them, which made it quite a big difference to people. And then just in the early 1890s, the first few cars began to appear. There were very few until around 1894, 1895. And at that time, there was no legislation to cover early motor vehicles. The only legislation that existed was for the very heavy steam traction engines that used to travel from town to town at harvest time, do the threshing of the crops and to assist with the processing of wood. And so automatically, motor cars that weighed no more than half a ton were in the same bracket when it came to legislation as these 15, 20-ton behemoths that would go around doing this work. And that simply wasn't right. And so there was a lot of pressure that was exerted by various people in this country, and the end result was there were three or four bills that were sent on their way through the House of Commons. And so in 1896, in May that year, the laws were passed that said, first of all, these cars could travel up to 14 miles an hour. They could travel on the road, providing they had lights in the hours of darkness. They had to have an audible mechanism to warn people that they were approaching. At the same time, the local authorities were given powers too. The local authorities could actually exercise their own speed limits in the localities. Actually, and that is no different to today, of course. I mean, most of the speed limits on the road are around 30 miles an hour, but in certain localities, 20 miles an hour.
Brighton in particular.
In particular. And it's not a bad thing. And so towns in those days could decide they wanted to impose a lower speed limit of 6 to 8 miles an hour, especially for the heavier vehicles. Also, the local authorities were entrusted with the rights to make sure that vehicles had appropriate tyres on, that they had brakes. And actually, for the very first time, the cars were allowed to travel on the road on the near side only, and they had to overtake only on the offside. And before 1896, basically you could drive on whichever side of the road you wanted to drive on. So that was a really important consideration. And also the other thing we should know about, of course, they had to have white lights to the front and red lights to the rear. One of the real big concerns in the mid-1890s was the carriage of explosive fuels. The trains wouldn't carry the fuel, which was a real problem for motorists. There was no way of transporting it around the country. And so drivers were allowed to carry two cans of fuel, and each one could not hold more than 20 guns.
It's amazing. And coupled with that, your car is French. So were the French the developers of the motor car?
There were two ways of answering that question. First of all, the first internal combustion engines were designed in Germany. Herr Benz was the man who designed the engine. But then he licensed companies like Peugeot and Panhard in France to manufacture engines. And whilst the Germans were the inventors, there's no doubt, there's no reason to believe that the French were not the ones that really exploited the commercial potential of early engines. And so all of the early largest motoring manufacturers were French, and Dion Bouton was one of those. In 1899-1900, it was the biggest manufacturer of motor vehicles in the world. By that stage, of course, the Americans hadn't really arrived on the scene. By 1903-1904, the Americans were manufacturing more motor vehicles than anybody else. But at the turn of the last century, the French motoring manufacturers were in the ascendancy. I should say, even though legislation was passed in this country in 1896, there was no real motor manufacturer in 1896 or 1897, actually not very much in 1898. And the reason for that was there was an individual called Harry Lawson who wanted to establish a monopoly of motor manufacture in this country. Tremendous entrepreneurial flair he had, but it wasn't matched with operational capability. So whilst he acquired licenses and patents to manufacture Didion Bouton vehicles in the UK and Leon Bollé and other marks as well, but he never really started the manufacturing process. So we were a little bit behind the French. By 1899, in this country, we were making motor cars, and by 1900, you could properly say that there was a British motor industry.
So the whole thing developed almost on the back of a cigarette packet.
Well, it started in a very small way. The early manufacturers, they had workshops that were probably no bigger than the size of the average garage. At the turn of the last century, there were scores of manufacturing companies in this country, and most of them folded. It's quite a complicated thing, manufacturing a motor vehicle. You need many hundreds of parts to manufacture a motor vehicle. And so what ultimately happened, and it happened the same way in France as well, of course, is that there were some individuals that had the wherewithal, the organisational capability to manufacture the cars, and then there were specialist manufacturers to manufacture the components. So there were wheel manufacturers, there were gearbox manufacturers, there were chassis manufacturers, and people that manufactured the electrics, and that's the way the industry evolved. What I should say is that certainly by the turn of the last century, it wasn't clear at that point that the internal combustion engine was going to be the engine of choice. There were lots of steam vehicles. There were lots of electric vehicles. Even up to the start of the First World War, most of the commercial vehicles in the UK were steam-driven. Not so in France. They tended to use the internal combustion engine. By the end of the First World War, by 1919, when production began to get back into action, it was clear at that point that the internal combustion engine was going to be the choice of automotive power.
So where did the red flag situation come from?
Well, the red flag was part of the legal requirement for the heavy vehicles to be on the road from 1865. And these, as I said, were the heavy threshing machines and steam-driven machines that used to go from farm to farm, and they were coming through really small village roads, and it was having somebody with a red flag in front was just a way of making sure that people, pedestrians, were safe. Actually, the red flag was abandoned in the 1880s, and I know that people talk about the 1896 legislation as being the abandonment of the red flag. It wasn't really. It's a nice picture to conjure up, but it's not really what happened.
Looking to the past, the establishment of the Veteran Car Club, how did that come about?
I said that the for the first run from London to Brighton by Veteran Cars was in 1896. After that, not a huge amount happened, actually. The Royal Automobile Club was the first meeting to discuss the foundation of an automobile club took place in December 1897, and that was in existence really from 1898, and that was a major component in promoting the responsible use of motor vehicles on the road. And they also organised events, and eventually it became the Royal Automobile Club, the RAC, as we know today. And they've been pivotal in ensuring that there are events for motorists to become involved in a responsible way. And then after the First World War, some of the cars began to make an appearance on the road, and there was a real concern that these cars were just disappearing. Veteran cars, they hadn't been used for a number of years, they were rusting, didn't work anymore, many people didn't know how they worked, they were simply being recycled, and they were being sent for scrap. And so the decision was made to instigate a rerun of the 1896 event in 1927, sponsored by the Daily Sketch. And that attracted around 30 cars in the first year. And by 1930, there were well over 100 cars taking part in the what was to become the annual London to Brighton run. And then some keen motoring enthusiasts were sitting in the old ship in Brighton, and the idea came up, why don't we think about starting a veteran car club? And it was started in a very small way, and it's been going ever since. So, we'll have the centenary of the Veteran Car Club in 2030. But throughout this time, the RAC and the Veteran Car Club have worked very closely together, then, as now, actually.
So how did the run from London to Brighton come about?
Well, actually, Brighton was a very attractive venue for Londoners, actually, ever since the train network was established in the 1860s, 1870s. So it was a very popular day out for Londoners. It was 62 miles, was a reasonable distance. It was quite a stretch for a veteran car. Most veteran cars, the smaller engine ones, were seen as being town cars. Although clearly by the end of 1904 there were twin and four cylinder cars that could travel rather more than 60 miles in a day, but 60 miles was seen to be quite a significant challenge. And actually, if you're driving a small engine veteran car these days, let me tell you, it is quite a challenge. There are quite a few hills between the centre of London and the centre of Brighton. So it was a popular destination for a start. People had lots to do when they arrived in Brighton, as they do now. And it was an interesting ride through the heart of London, past Buckingham Palace, down through the Mall, over Westminster Bridge. There was the opportunity of driving through some lovely Sussex countryside on the way down to the seafront. And there were a number of challenges on the way. I mean, there are a number of serious hills. Clayton Hill in particular got the car running pretty well. But as to how well it really is running, you find out when you're about to go Clayton Hill. Most cars make it. Some need to be towed up.
What's the attraction of a veteran car for you and your family?
I think it's multiple reasons for it, actually. One is the historical relevance. Veteran cars were there at the very start of motoring. Just think how much use we all make of motor cars these days. We don't even think twice about driving anywhere, or we just do it. And it all started in a really small way in 1896. So there's that historic aspect to the run. Secondly, it's been in my family for 90 years. Many of us know how to drive the car. My youngest daughter drives the car. So there's a continuity factor. The car's known as Fifi, by the way, and we don't need to talk about a car. We can just talk about Fifi within the family. People know exactly what we're talking about. And we have a family gathering before the event, after the event. We've got albums of the car from when it first arrived in the family and now. It provides an element of continuity. It is a fantastic day out. It is actually a fantastic spectator event as well. I mean, I've never had a chance to count how many spectators are on the route. I mean, you're so focused on driving the car, making sure it doesn't stall or stop, and it stays on the road. But it feels like there are many tens of thousands of people on the route, both in the centre of London and also especially going through some of the Sussex villages. Going through that long slope in Lindfield is fantastic. Yeah, and then, of course, coming into Brighton itself, kind of driving down Madeira Drive. It's a great feeling.
And what's the highlight of the run for you? Because sometimes the weather's not good.
Let me tell you, the one year in particular, which is quite recently, and I was sitting on the car at 6:20 in Hyde Park, I was absolutely saturated from inside, and we hadn't even started the run at that point. And these cars might look old and fragile, and some of them are, but they can still do 30 miles an hour. And when a strong wind and the rain is coming at you at 30 miles an hour, you certainly feel it, regardless of what you're wearing. But what does it mean? Well, it's a pivotal part of our year, really. I challenge anyone not to enjoy being in Hyde Park at 6:30 on a Sunday morning in November, where there are 450 cars, some internal combustion engine cars, some electric, some steam. There's noise and there's smells and there's the throng of people there. I mean, you will not be able to go to anywhere else on the planet where you will see 450 veteran cars together in one place on a Sunday morning. It's a fabulous start to the day. And then there's a challenge. It doesn't matter what's been going on in your week before or what you have coming up in your week following the run. All you can focus on that day is the car, because they are very temperamental and you've got to focus on what you're doing. And then, you know, when you come down Clayton Hill and you're heading for the A23 and you're heading towards the middle of Brighton, that's a great feeling.
You're home.
Home.
A final word for the visitors. What car should they look out for to see you on the run?
Well, mine's a Didion Bouton. It's grey. But I think I'd say to many people, though, if you're watching the run, try and see how many different kinds of cars there are. You know, I mean, these days we are focused on internal combustion engines and electric cars are about to arrive. You'd be surprised how many electric cars are running on the roads in 1900. There were lots of them. And also steamers as well. And you can always recognise a steamer. It's like a mobile kettle going along the road. It's a sheer variety, I think, which is the appeal.
Chris English was talking to Michael Edwards about this year's Veteran Car Run, which will be on November the 7th. If you'd like more information, you can go to their website, which is www.veterancarrun.com. That's www.veterancarrun.com. And Veteran Car Run is typed all as one word with no spaces. Now, during November, the charity Help for Heroes will be running a fundraising campaign to help with their work. To find out more about it, I spoke to Sarah Jones, and I began by asking her to tell me what Help for Heroes is and what they do.
We are a military charity that offers support to our UK military veterans and their family members.
And what sort of services do you provide for them?
We provide a whole range of services. Those services include support for mental health needs and also for physical health needs. That also includes fellowship structure as well. So it's a really kind of holistic model of recovery support that is designed to address the whole needs of the person, but also the family unit as well. So it's really kind of recognizing that there's not a one size fits all, but we really work to have a model in which we can assess someone's individual needs and then be able to tailor their recovery plan to what their current needs are.
The main psychological problem that the general public have heard about is post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD for short. What sort of effects does that have?
Post-traumatic stress disorder, abbreviated as PTSD, relates to when someone has had a traumatic experience where they feel that they have experienced a threat to themselves or to someone else that is significant to them. It's important to describe that in quite a generic way, because that can be quite far ranging in terms of what those experiences could be. And equally, that can be compounded. That can be a number of traumas that might have taken place for an individual. The key word within post-traumatic stress disorder is that it occurs after the event has taken place. So after the emergency or the trauma or the crisis has taken place, and usually the adrenaline around that, the energy around that has subsided, a stressful reaction can come from that. And we see the type of symptoms with PTSD that are characteristic are extreme levels of anxiety, flashbacks, sleep disturbances. You can have sensory flashbacks as well. So that can not necessarily relate to something visual, but could be smells, sounds, textures. It can be a whole range of sensory stimuli. What's important to kind of to recognize about PTSD is that there's some defining characteristics, but also interwoven within that can be anxiety symptoms, can be depression, and can be anger and relationship difficulties. So it's quite diverse.
So it can cause other things that the average person wouldn't think were related to the stress.
Exactly that. Yes.
And what sort of things can be done to help sufferers?
We offer a psychological support in terms of an assessment and treatment service. And that's really with one-to-one talking therapy. And also we run group programs that has quite a wide curriculum of lots of different group courses that can really help someone to understand their condition a lot better. Because as we're saying, you know, that might be related to one particular thing. It might be PTSD for one person, but actually it could be a range of issues. So like this survey shows, you know, and our data has given us recently, is that, you know, we know 73% struggle with their mental health on a daily basis, but also that 73% experience long-term pain and 82% experience difficulty with their sleep every day. So it's important to recognize that there can be a range of needs and a range of mental health and physical health care needs that our veterans and their families may be experiencing.
You mentioned a survey. This is a survey that Help for Heroes has conducted just recently.
It's a survey that we decided was really important to conduct to get a current indicator of what the needs of our veteran population are, especially given the circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic. So that survey gave us some very helpful information that we knew anecdotally from people coming forward for help. But it confirmed, you know, with these statistics and this hard data, that 60% of our beneficiary population were saying that their physical health has worsened during the pandemic, and 56% their mental health has deteriorated. So that's giving us that kind of picture of the cumulative impact of the pre-existing conditions that our veteran population have been experiencing and that we have been supporting them for many years, but also how the pandemic has had a impact on their overall health. So it really highlights how much there is still a need and how much we need to continue support our veteran population, and also how much we need the great British public to continue to support us as a charity, because we rely on them. You know, our charity exists 90% on the donations of the public. So without the public donations, we can't continue to do this critical work.
And I gather you're running a fundraising campaign in November, which seem to be an appropriate month, as it's the month when Armistice Day and Remembrance Sunday happen.
It's exactly right. You know, November is a very significant month with Remembrance Day. It's very emotive for our veteran population, but also it's very emotive for all of us to remember the sacrifice of our armed forces. And really, I believe our debt to them and their right to have the best support available to them when they need that. I really feel that very passionately, very strongly, particularly in terms of mental health support. I, you know, as a psychologist, that's very close to my heart, because in terms of mental health, it can often take many years for veterans to come forward for that support. So if it has taken somebody many years to ask for help, It's really important that we respond in a timely way. So our November campaign will really be about reminding the public of the important work that we continue to do, that we have continued to offer throughout the pandemic, and that we really need the public to support us. I would point people in the direction of our website, so helpforheroes.org.uk. And on our website, they'll be able to get information about the charity, about how they can make a donation, about how they can see information about what we do. And also on our Get Support page on our website is where veterans or family members of veterans can reach out for help and can put that inquiry into us, and we will respond to them. So go to our website, and that's how you'll be able to offer your support to us.
And as you say, if people need help themselves or for their relatives, they can also find out about that by going to the website.
Absolutely. We also have some self-help guides on the website. You know, sometimes that can be a first step for somebody to read some information, to get a bit of an idea of what might be the kind of help that would be beneficial. Sometimes that's all somebody needs, but importantly, it's making that first step. And that's why we've provided that information on our website. So I absolutely encourage anyone any of our veterans who feel that they're experiencing difficulties to reach out for that help and know that we are ready and waiting to offer our support to them.
Do you find that, people, especially men, are reluctant to ask for help because it's seen as a non-macho thing to need help like that? It's the old British stiff upper lip tradition coming out.
Yeah, it is definitely a phenomena that we observe. I believe that that has improved over the years. I've been working in mental health for over 20 years now. So culturally, we are better at talking about mental health. However, there still is a lot of stigma around asking for help, but particularly with our service personnel who have an outward focus on being in service to others and supporting others. So other people who tend to be good at being in service to others or caring for others, it tends to be harder for them to ask for help for themselves. So we've got this kind of combination, if you like, between perhaps some stigma around feeling that mental health or mental illness equals weakness, but also about, you know, sometimes some guilt and some shame around asking for help. So it's really important that we demystify that and we debunk that really and say, actually, this is a strength to ask for help. And actually, it makes us stronger.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Sarah, and I hope the campaign goes well.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I was talking to Sarah Jones about the fundraising campaign that Help for Heroes are running in November. If you want to find out more, you can go to their website, which is www.helpforheroes.org.uk. That's www.helpforheroes, which is typed all as one word, .org.uk. Or you can ring them on 0300 303 9888. That's 0300 303 9888. Now, another charity which is running a campaign, in this case during the month of October, is the RSPCA. And their campaign is entitled Adoptober. To find out more, I spoke to Jenny Eden from the RSPCA's Brighton Centre and asked her what sort of animals they deal with.
Pretty much everything. So we have dogs and cats, rabbits and small furries. We take in wildlife and we tend to temporarily hold those and then move them on to a long-term centre for rehabilitation and release. And we also have a big reptile rescue.
Oh, reptiles, that's quite unusual, isn't it?
We're the only RSPCA large reptile rescue in the country. So at any point we have around about 300 reptiles in the centre. So it's a purpose-built facility and we can take everything from little leopard geckos to monitors and tegus.
Now, this month, the RSPCA as a whole running a campaign called Adoptober. What's that about?
It's an annual campaign that we run to encourage people to adopt their animals from rescue rather than go to other sources for them. So it's a chance for us to talk about some of the animals that have been with us for longer, some of the harder to home animals, and just the joy of having a rescue pet in your life. So how rewarding they can be. And of course, animals have been so important to people over the last year, 18 months in lockdown. So many people have relied on their pets or got pets for that companionship in a really hard time. I like to look at Adoptober as kind of celebrating the joys of rescue at the same time as encouraging more people to do it.
And this is a campaign that you run every year, is it?
I think we've done it about 3 years now.
And you've got a slogan, which is Adopt, Don't Shop. Why is it a bad idea to buy a pet rather than going for a rescued one?
Well, it's so rewarding to enable an animal to have a second chance. There are so many animals in rescue that desperately, desperately need homes. And we can provide the support for adopters. If you're buying, there is obviously a trade in puppy farming, particularly, which makes a lot of money and generally causes a lot of misery to the dogs that are being bred, specifically the puppies that probably have poor standards of welfare. There are so many reasons why it's so much better to go for a rescue animal than go out there and buy it from the unknown. So many animals that need a second chance, that need that extra love, why would you go elsewhere?
And of course, getting an animal from you, it will have been thoroughly checked over by your vets and you'll know it's in good condition.
They've been vet checked, they will have had at least a first vaccine, they'll be microchipped, they'll be treated for fleas and worms. If they're old enough, they'll be neutered. If they aren't old enough or if they've got a health issue, you'll get a neutering voucher with them. So you get a lot of extras by getting an animal from rescue.
And how much does it actually cost to adopt a pet from you?
It's £170 for an adult dog, £200 for a puppy, £90 for a cat and £100 for a kitten.
Now, obviously somebody who's coming to you to adopt an animal will know that that animal is in good condition, as we said. How do you check over the people who are going to adopt the animal to make sure that it's going to a good home?
So what we ask everybody to do is fill out a perfect match form, which you can download from our website. And that tells us a lot about somebody who wants to adopt, so what their circumstances are, what their home's like, and that helps us find the right animal that is most likely to work with them. If we have an animal that we think would be that perfect match, we will then ring up and talk to somebody, so we'll get a bit more information out of them to make sure that we're all heading in the right direction, they're interested. And then we organise a home visit, so we have a team of volunteer home visitors who will come round, talk to the adopter about what they're taking on, make sure they're aware of everything they're taking on. And at that point, we can make the adoption happen. So we'll have invited somebody in to meet the animal on site. And at that point, somebody may say no. And that's absolutely fine, because the most important thing is we get it right and we get an animal into a forever home that's really going to work for them. We then do a post-adoption check. So we'll be in touch after somebody's adopted to make sure everything's settling in right. If they've got any issues, we try and help and support them. So we do a lot of checks, but our checks are, rather than being a barrier to somebody adopting, they're far more about making sure that it's the right person and the right pet, and that they're making a match that's going to last a lifetime.
Yes, that's very good for all concerned, isn't it? Okay, well, thanks very much, Jenny. It's been very interesting, and I can certainly recommend your service, having adopted a cat from you a few years ago, and she's still very happy, and we are very happy with her. Thanks, Jenny. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I was talking to Jenny Eden of the RSPCA in Brighton about their Adoptober campaign. You can find out more from their website, which is www.rspca-brighton.org.uk/contact. That's www.rspca-brighton.org.uk/contact. Or you can phone them on 01273 554 218. That's Brighton 554 218. If you want to contact the RSPCA in an emergency to report a case of animal cruelty, there's a different number to ring, which is 0300 1234 999. That's 0300 1234 999. Until very recently, Barry Wordsworth was the principal conductor and musical director of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra. He's retired from that post just recently, and a new incumbent has taken over. It's the well-known concert pianist Joanna McGregor. When I spoke to Joanna, I put it to her that she's best known as a concert pianist and asked her if conducting was something new for her.
I first conducted about 20 years ago. I conducted the Britten Sinfonia a great deal. We went on tour all over the world together, not just in this country. And I've conducted other orchestras like the RPO and I think the Philharmonia at one point. It's quite a normal thing for a pianist to do, because it's quite normal to direct from a keyboard. And inevitably, the pianist sort of seems to be playing the most notes. So even if you play chamber music very often, you're kind of very much sort of in charge, as it were. So it's not unusual. You'll know loads of pianists who do conducting, of course. So it's a well-worn path.
Is it difficult playing the piano and conducting at the same time?
I think it's a very natural thing to do. And in fact, in my role as head of piano at the Royal Academy of Music, I train all my pianists to do this. It's obviously what used to happen. The invention of a conductor is a 19th century invention. And up until then, an orchestra was led either by the fiddle player at the front or by the harpsichord player. And of course, Mozart used to do all his concertos from the keyboard. And so it's a kind of quite normal state of affairs in a way. I think you just have to learn to conduct with your left hand sometimes.
Right. Now, what attracted you to the job with the Brighton Philharmonic?
Well, I was asked. And you have to ask them what attracted them to me. I didn't know that there was a job happening. They contacted me. The then chair, Nick Chisholm, wrote to me. And I was aware of Brighton Philharmonia because I'd met the previous chair a long time ago, many, many years ago. I'm a friend of Gavin Henderson, who's involved with the orchestra, one of the sponsors of the trumpet chair. I think probably I'm known as a festival director. I've run very big festivals like Bath Festival and Dartington Summer School. Ran a festival at the Royal Opera House. And so this idea of running things, I'm quite well known for. So that might be the reason they asked me.
Yes, you sound as if you were an ideal candidate. What does the job actually involve?
I think when you're the music director of an orchestra, it's your job to obviously program all the concerts, think about who's going to play in the concerts, and that includes guest leaders and anybody extra that you need to book. You know, it's most orchestras have got a core of players, but there are lots of extra players you have to ask all the time. Obviously, you think about who are the guest artists you want, soloists you want to come, direction you want to take the orchestra in. And obviously, your job is to liaise between the orchestra and the public. And so very often music directors are people who are quite communicative and are willing to do quite a lot of publicity. I mean, in this particular case, because it's a very small management, very small administration. I mean, I've written all the text for the brochure. I've selected publicity. I've liaised with the designer. I'm used to all this from running festivals. So, you know, it's a much bigger job than just playing music. That my first rehearsal for that first concert, I put out the music stands and I put out the music. So, you know, things are quite tough in the arts.
Has it been difficult devising a programme of live concerts for the current situation?
Well, I was obviously appointed a year and a half ago and then COVID hit. You know, they didn't finish the season. They were trying to finish off the orchestra. And the idea was I would meet the public. You know, everything was cancelled by then. And we had a whole season of concerts ready to go, and they all got cancelled for a year. The Dome closed. And during that year, we did lots of chamber music because we were anxious. You know, I wanted to meet the players and it seemed like a good way of keeping music going. So they started off online, these chamber concerts. And it was a great way to meet some principal players and to play some great music, keep things going in Brighton a bit. And I would say the only difficulty coming back is that not so much that we changed the programme, we had to change a couple of things, is how many players you want to have on stage, because it's a little bit unknown still, the sense of social distancing, how many people we can have. So our first few concerts are with chamber-sized orchestras, just so that everybody's got plenty of space. If anything difficult happens, we're able to turn on a sixpence, you know, and change things. I think this is, in the arts, COVID's taught you to be very quick thinking and very flexible and, you know, able to change things if you need to.
And what plans do you have for the Brighton Philharmonic in the future?
Well, it's a centenary coming down the track in 2025. So I've been talking to the board a lot about, obviously, we need to raise our fundraising and raise our awareness in Brighton, you know, so more and more people come. I've done quite a mixed programme this year. You'll notice there's plenty of folk and jazz and film, as well as standard symphonic repertoire. So we're hoping to reach out to even more audiences and even bigger audiences. I think that's the job, really, both to keep it afloat financially, but also artistically keep on developing and have fun. And the players are wonderful. I mean, they're really fun. They've all written to me saying how great the season is going to be and how exciting it all is. So I get the sense that the players are really up for almost anything. And we'll be doing a lot of collaborations. Of course, we've got the great Catherine Tickell coming in December. And she's an amazing person. I've worked with her lots of times and we're doing film with Neil Brand. So, I mean, there's really nice things to do. I think also I'm quite interested in showcasing the actual players in the orchestra. So for the people who came to our first concert, they'll have noticed that we showed off the bass player in a Piazzolla tango. I deliberately picked Mozart because that shows off all the woodwind playing and the horn playing. And, you know, a lot of the programming will be a bit like that so that the audience can appreciate how wonderful and virtuosic these players are.
Yeah, sounds great. And I know from looking at your CV that you actually perform a wide range of types of music, don't you?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I played Bart Goldberg variations 1 week and then Mary Lou Williams, who's a jazz pianist, the next, and played Beethoven fourth piano concerto 1 week and then something very contemporary immediately after that. So I think that's the way a lot of musicians are now. We're all interested in a wide range of music all the time, and we love playing a wide range of music.
And you're going to bring all this wide range of music into the Brighton Philharmonic concerts if you can.
Well, it's already there. If you look at the season, I mean, the season we're doing now, we, you know, it ranges from Brahms and Elgar and Mozart straight over to folk and jazz and tangos, and, you know, so it's got a very nice mix of things for the orchestra to do.
The next concert is one that you're actually not involved in, isn't it?
That's right. I've programmed some Baroque music and I've asked a really good friend of mine, Robert Howarth, who's just an amazing harpsichord player and conductor, to come along. He used to run the Baroque opera course for me at Dartington. We used to do a big Baroque opera every year. And he's very witty as well as a marvellous musician. And we've asked a singer who's very well known for singing Baroque opera, Gillian Keith, to come along. And she's doing some show-stopping arias of Handel and Purcell. And actually, again, this goes back to the virtuosity of the players, because I've programmed part of Vivaldi's Seasons, which will really show off Ruth Rogers, the leader, and Brandenburg Concerto number 2, which, of course, has got a fabulous high trumpet part, which will show off our principal trumpet player. And it's a bit like sort of Baroque hits, really, one after another. It's absolutely great. And it's tied together with this idea of earth, air, fire and water. I love Baroque music. I play a lot of Baroque music on the piano, but I thought I'd better hand it over to a harpsichordist so he can do the real thing.
So what else is coming up?
I'm really excited about Catherine Tickell coming in December. I know she'll be very, very popular. You know, she's got this huge following and we're going to do a whole folk-inspired collaboration, you know, ranging from James McMillan and Vaughan Williams and other well-known classical composers like Bartok to her stuff. And we're reviving our Christmas Carol with the brass quintet because that was so popular last year. And then early next year, Barry's coming back. He's going to conduct a wonderful programme of French music and Mendelssohn. And one of my own students is going to play the Ravel Piano Concerto. She's terribly glamorous, rather brilliant young pianist called Junyun Chen. And we're finishing with Brahms and Elgar. So there's so much to choose from. It's great.
There is. Let's hope that you get a good audience for all this. And I'll be telling people how they can get tickets in a moment or so. Gianna, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely talking to you and hope to see you again very soon.
I was talking to the new artistic director and principal conductor of the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra, Gianna McGregor. The next concert in the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra's season is on November the 7th, and it's entitled Great Baroque, Playing with Fire. It features music by Purcell, Handel, and Vivaldi. You can get tickets from the Brighton Dome ticket office. This you can contact by going to their website, which is tickets.brightondome.org/online. That's tickets.brightondome, and Brighton Dome is typed all as one word, .org/online. And you can find out more about the whole of the Brighton Philharmonic season by going to their website, which is www.brightonphil.org.uk/whats-on. That's www.brightonphil, and Phil there is spelt P-H-I-L, .org.uk/whats-on. And you can phone them on Brighton 234801. That's 01273 234801. And that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in 4 weeks. Until then, it just remains for me to thank everyone who's taken part, to thank you for listening, and to wish you all the very best until we meet again. Thanks for listening, take care, and goodbye.